The program tonight is a seminar debate, sort of a debate in quotes, debate format, you might say. The topic is Saving the Environment, Government Friend or Foe, which is intended to be a broadly conceived approach to the debate over environmental policy. For those of you new to the Institute, hopefully you've received a packet when you registered, which has background information about our program. The Independent Institute is a non-politicized scholarly public policy research organization. We produce many books. We have a quarterly journal that you may have seen upstairs. We also publish other publications and hold lots of conference and media programs based on that work. Our interest is not to get involved in politics. Our interest is to hopefully get to the truth as best as we can and make that available to people interested in resolving many issues. Our program tonight is part of a series that we hold. I might point out in your packet there is a green sheet that describes tonight's program. Also, it lists two upcoming events. The next event will be on February 15th, on Tuesday. The topic is Global Warming, Scientific Fact or Fiction. The speaker will be Dr. Fred Singer, who's president of the Science and Environmental Policy Project, who happens also to be with us this evening. Fred is also the first director of the U.S. Weather Satellite Service. He's a distinguished fellow of the Institute for Space Science and Technology, and is author of a book called Hot Talk, Cold Science. Then on March 7th, we switch topics completely. The topic then will be pro-team sports. Are politics and corruption winning? And we will be having two top sports economists, Roger Noel from Stanford, who's co-editor of a book called Sports, Jobs, and Taxes, The Economic Impact of Sports Teams and Stadiums. The second speaker is Rodney Fort, who's professor of economics at Washington State University and is co-author of the new book, Hardball, The Abuse of Power in Pro-Team Sports. If you're not familiar with the disputes in sports, this is a great way to learn something about it, and I think you'd be quite intrigued by many issues that are raised. For this evening, we're very pleased to have several top scholars and policy analysts with us. Our program features, as you know, Peter Huber and Michael D'Alessi. They'll be discussing environmental quality, science, government policy. And I'd like to introduce our panel, if I could. Starting on my right, Peter Huber, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Next to him is Michael D'Alessi, who directs the Center for Private Conservation. Tom Graff, who is the senior attorney at the Environmental Defense Fund here in the Bay Area, and Sally Fairfax, who's professor in the College of Natural Resources at the University of California, Berkeley. Peter Huber's work, as many of you may know, has pioneered a number of important areas. It's pioneered important work in legal liability, in telecommunications, regulation, and many other fields. He is probably best known for his critical analysis that's brought the issue of junk science to the forefront, especially as it has affected the legal system. Michael D'Alessi has applied both economic and marine science to develop new approaches to the management of fisheries and other resource systems. Peter, of course, is the author of the new book, Hard Green, which has been receiving a lot of attention recently. Michael is a contributing author of the new book, Earth Report 2000, which is also receiving quite a bit of attention. This is the book, Earth Report 2000, which there are copies upstairs, in case you hadn't noticed. And of course, this is Peter Huber's new book, Hard Green, which just came out and is available as well. Both Peter and Michael are raising important questions pertaining to the basis for how we approach environmental issues. Since the first Earth Day, I guess it was two decades ago, government policy, especially in the environment, has expanded into almost all aspects of our lives. There are few areas that it doesn't touch, including the food we eat, the air we breathe, our homes, our jobs, and so forth. And for years, the conventional wisdom has been that government management, government bureaucratic approaches to natural resource management, to food quality, to many other issues, was essential to conserve and protect our lives and ecological systems. However, there's an increasing number of scholars who are wondering whether indeed a collectivist approach does work as effectively as you might think, and whether the presumptions behind a lot of the claims of environmental policy are what they are, and perhaps there are issues that have not been raised that are even more serious. At the Institute, Garrett Hardin's famous essay, The Tragedy of the Commons, is one that we take to heart. We believe that Garrett's work was a fundamental insight into the nature of not just ecological systems, but economic systems, and we're interested in trying to find how incentives and such systems can be brought into line. In other words, how to bring the economic factors and the ecological factors into par. Similarly, in food and drug safety, there are issues that pertain to biogenetics, as many of you know, and biotechnology. But the thing that's interesting about so many of these issues is that they're not just issues of the research scientist anymore. They're issues that are being debated in fields ranging from economics, patent law, world trade issues, antitrust, and many other factors. Is technology a threat to mankind? Is technology a benefit to mankind? We have to sort out these kinds of issues somehow. To do so, the format of our program tonight, and of course we can only really just touch on a small number of things tonight, but we can certainly begin a dialogue. The format of our program will be to have each of our two major speakers speak for 20 minutes, beginning with Michael. Afterward, our panel of Tom and Sally will each comment for 5 minutes. Then Michael and Peter will have an opportunity to respond or have other comments for 5 minutes. And then we'll open up the program to questions from all of you. So our first speaker is one other thing I should mention, I almost forgot. I'm not sure what's wrong with me. We have a new book coming out also. Of course, this is premature. I don't want to take away from the thunder of our distinguished guests or not. But we have a book coming out this winter. This is actually a dummy of it, just the cover, called Cutting Green Tape. And the book is going to be dealing with essentially environmental issues, both regulatory and tort law issues, as well as some different aspects of the scientific basis of toxicology and so forth. The title, I should mention, of the book is referring to two aspects of the issue. One is the bureaucratization of our lives and what we should do about that. The second is a program that some of you may be familiar with called Green Scissors, which is a program that a number of environmental groups had implemented as far as their attempt to try and cut back on corporate welfare, which is something that we also are very much concerned with. So our interest is to, again, combine ecological and environmental concerns. So as I was saying, our first speaker is Michael D'Alessi. As I said, he's director of the Center for Private Conservation. He's an expert in marine conservation and private conservation programs. He received his BA in economics and his MS in engineering economic systems from Stanford. He has an MA in marine policy from the Rosenthal School of Marine and Atmospheric Science at the University of Miami. In addition to his being a contributing author to the book Earth Report 2000, he is author of the monograph Fishing for Solutions from the Institute of Economic Affairs in London, and his articles have appeared in The New Scientist, International Herald Tribune, The Wall Street Journal, and elsewhere. So I'm very pleased to introduce Michael D'Alessi.
Well, thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here. I guess I'll start trying to characterize the book a little bit, since it is a book forum. What I think the Earth Report book is trying to do is really to take a positive view of our world and of the environment. It recognizes problems such as the effects of DDT on bird populations and the depletion of fisheries, but it also stresses the vital role that human ingenuity and creativity plays in shaping our world and its ability to overcome a lot of the problems that we face. Human ingenuity is exactly why Malthus was wrong when he predicted that population growth would outstrip our ability to feed ourselves. I mean, in fact, agricultural productivity has increased far more rapidly instead. Earth Report 2000 also tries to critically assess how the role of government has affected not only the quality of our environment, but the quality of the science that has addressed these many of these environmental issues and how it will likely continue to do so in the future. The book tries to ask some hard questions about other perceived threats, such as global warming and the notion of overconsumption. Just how serious are these threats? And does the proposed solution really accomplish anything positive? For example, did you know that, this is from a chapter by Roy Spencer, did you know that it has been estimated that the Earth has warmed by about 1 degree centigrade over the last century, and that most of that warming has occurred at night and during the coldest winter months? And most of this warming occurred earlier in the century. Using satellite data, it has been estimated that the increase in global temperatures between 1979 and 1997 has been 0.1 degree of Celsius. So what does that say about the proposed government interventions of the Kyoto Protocol? Well, I think it's still quite open to debate, but I hope articles such as the one in this book encourage people to discuss and to check the science more carefully on both sides of the issue. The chapter titled Doing More with Less looks at how market processes naturally try to reduce the use of materials. Lynn Scarlett, who wrote the chapter, likes to do her aluminum can trick, where she takes a Coke can from the late 1970s and tries her best to crush it. It feels like it's made of steel, and she takes one that she bought last week and crushes it in one hand because there's so much less metal in those cans today. Going back to global warming, the more exhaust a car emits, the less efficient its engine is. Do we really need government to improve the conversion of gas in an automobile? Lynn Scarlett writes, pick the winner strategies that use the political process to anoint specific technologies as better or best, undermine the constant competitive discovery process of the market, and could perversely lead to more, not less, waste. If I can steal a quote from Peter's book, he says it more succinctly when he says, coerced efficiency, like coerced recycling, is simply another instance of doing things well that should not be done at all. Which leads into another chapter entitled Richer is More Resilient, which is largely an indictment of government intervention policies that tend to perpetuate poverty when there's no doubt that wealthier is healthier. We've proven it in this country with how much more we care about environmental quality. But try asking someone living on the street in the third world just where saving the snail darter lies among their priorities, and I think you'll get a very different answer. Peter covers many of these issues in his book and can speak more knowledgeably than I can about the issues of energy production and its effect on land use, or what's wrong with so much of the so-called scientific modeling that's used to predict imminent disaster these days, which I hope he'll cover in his comments. But to return to human ingenuity, another central theme of the book is the role of institutions and incentives in environmental protection. My chapter is on the fisheries, and that's what I know most about, and it's particularly relevant in that discussion. There is no doubt that many of the world's fisheries are in a state of decline, but why? All too often, it's because government conservation programs have failed to understand and take account of the importance of these institutions and the incentives that they create. Very often, the conservation policy encourages people to catch as many fish as possible, often as quickly as they can, albeit in the face of the regulatory constraints that they face, and even though that harms them in the long run. In the short run, if they don't catch something, their neighbor will, and so they do. This has resulted in some rather extreme examples of regulatory failure. One I would say is the cod fisheries of New England. It used to be one of the world's most productive fisheries, and today it's hovered near commercial extinction for years. The Alaskan halibut fishery has changed now, but a few years ago, the idea to reduce catches in that fishery was simply to shorten the season. They thought, well, if there's less time to catch fish, they won't catch as many. And in a fairly short period of time, the season went from somewhere close to 9 months to 48 hours, two separate 24-hour fishing derbies with no real reduction in catch, just a lot more loss of life and damage and investment in huge boats and nets. Because all of that ingenuity that was out there was channeled into finding a way to beat the system, not into finding a way to protect and enhance resources. There's been one successful restriction of technology that I'm aware of, and that's on the skipjacks, the oyster-catching boats in the Chesapeake. And the way they've successfully limited their ability to catch oysters there is that it's the last commercial sailing fleet in the United States. They still use wooden boats that are 60 to 70 feet long and powered by sail and can only drag oysters off the bottom in about a 5-knot range of the wind, which doesn't really matter because there aren't any more oysters left out there anyway, basically. My point is that systems based on private ownership, however, channel that ingenuity into protecting resources. If we contrast the Chesapeake oyster example to Washington State, where there's fee simple ownership of the oyster beds, not public oyster beds like there are in Maryland, the oyster industry has done quite well. It's gone through some problems as well, but it's innovated and it's stuck it out, and it's got a tremendous. They've got a lot of the Chesapeake oysters growing there now, and I don't know exactly what the figures are, but they're working a lot harder to bring them back than the folks in Maryland are. One of the best examples of a regulatory change in that direction is in New Zealand, where they've created transferable quotas to catch a specific percentage of a total harvest. It gets a little bit confusing, but basically what it means is you have a right to catch a certain amount of fish every year that changes based on how big the fishery is, and it's freely tradable. You can sell it, you can lease it, you can do anything you want. And that's resulted in the industry there has invested tremendous amounts in research on its own. They've had fleets that have voluntarily reduced their catches, and industries have worked together. There's a challenger scallop enhancement company that was formed among all the owners of the scallop fishery, and they've not only invested a lot in the technology of how to seed and enhance that fishery, but they've contracted with the people who have rights to the dredge oyster fishery and to the inshore fin fishery to manage the whole thing as one fishery. Particularly in this country, we hear all sorts of problems about how do you manage fisheries with all these multi-species interactions, and they're doing it in New Zealand, and they didn't set out to do it. They just gave the rights to each fishery to folks, and then it suddenly, all that ingenuity was channeled into making everybody better off, including the scallops. Of course, it's not a solution that can be applied everywhere. It gets even trickier when you go out into international waters, but I think it's important to get it straight in our own waters first. And there's a lot of effects at the margin when you move toward private arrangements that can start addressing some of these problems. For example, they created these quotas in Australia for the bluefin tuna fishery they had there. Bluefin tuna migrate over thousands of miles. But because this fishery in Western Australia had specific rights to that fishery, they actually went out and started talking to the Japanese and worked out an arrangement where the Japanese would let more of the fish go and get to Australia, and then they'd let the Japanese catch some there. Of course, it creates problems when the Koreans decide to do something, but at least it's working in the right direction. It's getting those folks to talk. Private rights also affect environmental quality at the margin. Going back to the oysters in Washington State example, the oyster growers there don't own any right to clean water. But because their livelihood depends on it, they've been the strongest defenders of water quality in that state for almost a century. And I think they're the reasons why a place like Willapa Bay, which is just above the Columbia River, is one of the cleanest estuaries in the United States. Many of the same institutional principles are covered in the biodiversity chapter in Earth Report. And because of these sort of this positive institutional arrangements that have come up, I'm a firm believer in the potential for other private conservation methods to provide environmental amenities that people value, including a sense of wilderness. I think that saying we value wilderness means we're making an economic calculation to conserve it, because economics, after all, is as much about subjective notions of value as it is about simple finance. So to me, agreeing that we value a notion of wilderness means that's a great opportunity for this human ingenuity to be tapped into, to find a way of providing that amenity on both large and small scales. And I think the long and varied history of private conservation, both in the United States and around the world, is evidence of that. Often in direct opposition to government policy. We recently did a case study of a place called Hawk Mountain in Pennsylvania. It was formed by an early suffragette who, when that cause was over, switched her interest to conservation, particularly of raptors. And there was a mountain in Pennsylvania known as Hawk Mountain, where bounty hunters, well, not bounty hunters, but folks would go up there to shoot raptors because the state put a bounty on these hawks because the chicken farmers thought they were a nasty thing. And there was actually a secondary industry. There was so much shooting up there that they had folks who'd go up there and basically harvest all the brass from the shells that were left over. They'd been shooting so many of these things. And she tried to get the state to get rid of this bounty, and it wouldn't happen. So she decided to, she found a way, she raised some money and bought the mountain and protected it and posted it, no hunting, no shooting. And it's still there today. It's still privately protected and open to the public. It's one of the most, it's a world famous raptor watching spot still. Many of the private conservation initiatives in this country have been localized, but I think it can work on a grand scale too. I was in Zimbabwe a couple years ago and had the chance to visit a private conservancy there that was formed by a number of ranchers who decided that wildlife was better for them economically than cattle. So they tore down every single internal fence that existed in their properties and put up a double electric fence around it and started bringing the wildlife back. And that's almost 1 million acres large. There's a place called Earth Sanctuaries Limited in Australia that's in the business of saving Australia's endangered native wildlife. And in their plan is to have 1% of Australia's land mass within their system of private wildlife reserves, and they're well on their way to raising that kind of money. Teddy Roosevelt said that he loved silent places unworn of man, but unfortunately I don't think there are any of those places left. A garden must be weeded, and so must a disturbed ecosystem. Since all ecosystems are now disturbed, humans, I think, have been quite effective at going everywhere in large numbers. I think the question is not whether to build walls around nature, but how to decide who shall be the gardeners. And as gardeners at every scale, I think the government has generally failed. The national parks have suffered especially from the trend toward natural regulation, which means, in effect, doing nothing. Randall O'Toole has put it nicely. He said, what this essentially means is that if 10,000 elk starve to death after eating all of the available forage, park managers can simply say, it's not us, it's nature. In other cases, similar attempts to actively protect wilderness have also led to disastrous results. If you can tell the difference between a brown tree and a green tree, then you can fly over many of the national forests of the West, especially in California, and among the sea of trees that are there, you can tell exactly where the property lines are between private and public lands. These national forests were initially set up for logging, but over about the past 30 years, that focus has changed to protecting wilderness. What this has led to is fire suppression, which has meant that instead of big, beautiful forests with big trees and green open areas underneath, the fire suppression has created a dense underbrush, so that now when there is a fire, it burns hot enough to reach the crowns of the bigger trees and killing them. They're also more susceptible to disease and pests like bark beetles. On the private lands, however, there has been a fair amount of salvage harvest, work to limit noxious pests, and control of the undergrowth. The Everglades have suffered for the same reason. The Park Service there has stopped the age-old practice of burning the glades every year, and the resulting fuel buildup has meant that much hotter fires burn every few years, which burn up lots of the mangroves' hammocks and will probably take years, hundreds of years to return. A landlord with the record of the federal government would be widely condemned, not extolled, which is why I think it's dangerous to hold up Teddy Roosevelt as a conservation icon. First, the progressives that the TR led, I don't think were motivated to conserve wilderness. Gifford Pinchot wrote in 1903 that the object of our forest policy is not to preserve the forest because they are beautiful or because they are refuges for wild creatures of the wilderness, but for the making of prosperous homes. I think in a similar vein, Yellowstone was not created out of a notion of pristine wilderness, but at the behest of the railroads who wanted a destination for their passengers to head for. Samuel Hayes, who wrote a fantastic book on conservation at the turn of the century, wrote that for Roosevelt and the progressives, conservation gave wide scope to government by experts, to investigations by commissions, to efficiency in planning and execution. The crux of their approach, he wrote, lay in a rational and scientific method of making basic technological decisions through a single central authority. Well, to me, a technocratic system like that sounds remarkably reminiscent of what happened in the former communist countries, where we all know there was a creation of a well-documented environmental nightmare. Now, I don't think we're anywhere near that kind of environmental nightmare here yet, but we do have tens of millions of acres in danger of catastrophic fire and a socialist approach to land management and ownership. In fact, I think part of the Roosevelt legacy was summed up by the noted liberal economist John Kenneth Galbraith, who noted some time ago that, in testimony to Congress, the public lands of the United States exceed the combined areas of Germany, France, Italy, Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, Denmark, and Albania. Where socialized ownership of land is concerned, only the USSR and China can claim company with the United States. I think with the changes in those countries, I suspect the United States now stands alone. Land ownership in the United States at the federal level hovers around 30%. The numbers are difficult to get, but when you add state and local, you're up to at least 40%. There's been big news in Arizona recently with the creation of a new national monument there, where 87% of Arizona is already owned by government at all levels. In California, it's about 45% ownership by the federal government. Despite what the government owns and how badly it has been managed, there's an ever-increasing call for more land. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt said in an interview just this January, quote, "We need to build on the Teddy Roosevelt vision. We need more public land." Thanks. But how much is enough? I'm hardly suggesting that we sell our national parks. They do instill, I think, a strong feeling, a good feeling about our nation, at least until we learn how mismanaged they are. And I'm not suggesting we should sell them off wholesale. But I get my sort of warm, fuzzy feelings elsewhere. I get them from knowing that the black rhino is on the road to recovery in Africa because of the creation of private conservancies in countries like Zimbabwe, that endangered species in Australia have a vigilant private steward looking after them. And in this country, I'm inspired by the private protection of places like Mount Vernon or the Natural Bridge of Virginia, which Thomas Jefferson bought from King George shortly before the Revolutionary War. Private ownership has not destroyed the value of these national landmarks. It has preserved them. They also demonstrate, I think, that private conservation on a large scale doesn't have to mean something like Disney. There's a lot in between. Visit a private conservancy in Zimbabwe and track rhino there, and you're in a totally different world. You really feel like you probably feel like Teddy Roosevelt felt when he first got there. So given these successes, I think one of the biggest problems we have to address is the issue of legal impediments to private conservation. TR was noted for granting federal protection to waterfowl on Florida's Pelican Island, which was commonly raided by poachers after eggs and plumes. And the Audubon Society at the time, who were already creating their own private reserves, met with TR to persuade him to sell them Pelican Island so that they could protect the waterfowl. TR thought this was a great idea, but there was simply no legal way for him to do it. So instead, he used an executive order to make Pelican Island a reserve under the Agricultural Department. If there had been a way to sell Pelican Island to Audubon, then I'm not sure we'd be having this discussion today. I'll mention one other legal change that I think has had a dramatic effect, and that's been on water markets. Another case study we did was on the Oregon Water Trust, obviously, in Oregon. And the law there used to say that the water law was basically use it or lose it. If you didn't use it for something, quote, beneficial, you lost it. And leaving it in the stream for salmon wasn't a beneficial use, which caused all sorts of problems. Not too long ago, there was a change in the law that made leaving water in stream a beneficial use, and all of a sudden you created this organization called the Oregon Water Trust, which has gone out and bought these water rights to leave in stream. It's ended a lot of conflicts, and I think it's been a fantastic innovation. So in conclusion, I think to say that private conservation will necessarily fail on any level, when all too often it hasn't been given the chance, prejudges the issue and neglects the creative evolutionary ability of societies to evolve both property rights and liability rules to these to resolve these emerging concerns. From this perspective, our current environmental concerns reflect the suppression of this discovery process. And I think the challenge is to find ways to restart and to re-legitimize a decentralized, voluntary approach to environmental issues, and hopefully to extend more of the private conservation success stories that I mentioned. Thank you.